3. By 5 o'clock that morning, Brown Limper's staffer knew he had found Tyler. For days now, he had been unable to sleep, or even sit down quietly or eat. Forgotten were all other cares of state. Forgotten were all other tasks that ordinarily occupied his time. With a wild, intent glare in his eyes, for nearly 24 hours a day, he had concentrated only upon closing the trap which had been set. Crime must be punished. A malefactor must be brought to book. The safety and integrity of the state must be given priority. Almost every text he had studied on government, all advice he had been given, proved to him only one thing. He had to get Tyler. Victory had begun to beckon with a drone picture he took off the machine at 3 a.m. He had trouble with these machines. Ever since these recorders had been moved to the Capitol, he had been irritated by their incomprehensible complexity, and he often hit them when they failed to spit out what was wanted. It made him feel martyred having to do all this work with so little help. But he had been scanning the tray of drone takes that were rolling out from Scotland. The pilot who handled drone control and these machines was not here at this time of day. A nuisance. And there was Tyler, dancing one of those insane prances the Highlanders did, by bonfire with half a dozen others. Although the pictures were silent, a pain went through his ears as he imagined the crazy pipe music that must have been playing. Yes, hunting shirt and all, it was Tyler. The machine gave him a lot of trouble trying to backtrack its trace. He never could tell one cyclo number from another. But he managed it and got a blown-up view. It wasn't Tyler. He realized then he was not being logical. Tyler would not be dancing and flinging his arms about. The last time he had seen him down at the compound, Tyler had been limping heavily on a cane and had no use of his right arm. But at 4:48 a.m., a picture from another drone, then overflying the Lake Victoria area, spewed out and showed a man by the lake throwing rocks in the water. A man with a hunting shirt, same hair, same beard. Tyler. But it couldn't be Tyler because he was using his right arm to throw, and as he drew back, it was obvious he had no limp. He had no more than thrown the pictures down on the floor when Lars Thorensen rushed in as though he had news. Brown Limper let him have it, but good. What were two Tylers doing visible on two different drones in such a short time apart, yet so widely separated on the Earth's surface? "That's what I'm trying to say," cried Lars. "There are three Scots who look like Tyler, but that isn't it. You know what Turl told us to look for? Scars on Tyler's neck from the collar he wore so long. I couldn't understand why Stormalong was wearing his scarf so high around his neck. He never did before. And just 5 minutes ago, I woke up with the whole thing plain as daylight. He's hiding those scars. Tyler is down in that compound right now posing as Stam Stavanger. Stormalong." For all the wrong reasons, they had reached the right conclusions. Brown Limper went into immediate action. Time and time again, Lars had told him about this great military hero, Hitler, and his faultless campaigns. Turl had impressed foresight upon him. He had been ready for this moment. 2 days before, he had finalized the contract with General Smith. 100 credits a day per man was a lot to pay, but Smith was worth it. Two commandos had gone by truck to the village in the high meadow. There was no town meeting. The villagers had been swept up regardless of any protest. They had been hastily relocated in the distant village on the other side of the mountain Tyler had once chosen for them. The 5 youths who might have said something were at the academy, 3 of them learning machine operation and how to keep the passes open in winter with blade scrapers, the other 2 learning to be pilots. Old people and young children didn't have to be listened to, and their pleas that their preparations for the coming winter were now ruined could be ignored. As a concession to political sagacity, they had been told they were being moved so the old tactical mines could be dug up and disposed of. These mines, they knew now that they were explosives buried long ago, and Brown Limper had shown them this was just another instance of Tyler's lies, had their own role to play in this clever strategy. Tyler's old home had then been booby-trapped with grenades and blasting caps, and Brown Limper had been assured by the Brigante explosive experts that all Tyler would have to do was open a door and he would be blown to bits. The story would be that Tyler had gone to his house despite warnings about the old mines, and that one had blown up. In this way, there could not possibly be any outcry or blame attached to Brown Limper. The senior mayor Planet was a bit hazy on whether this had been his own idea or Turl's. But no matter, it was brilliant political thinking. The state and nation must be freed of the scourge, the arch-criminal Tyler, and with a minimum of repercussion to the body politic. Also, Brown Limper had read someplace that the end justifies the means, and this seemed to be a sound basic policy. Brown Limper realized, when he thought about it, that he was becoming a statesman ranked with the most stellar figures of ancient man. At 6 a.m., he ordered General Smith to begin changing the guard at the compound. The cadets were to be permanently relieved on the grounds they didn't like the duty and it interrupted their studies, and the state now had a proper standing army. Brigantes were to be on guard duty there by 8 a.m. A hasty call had ascertained that the other two, with Storm along, had left some time ago for the academy, and it was so logged by the duty officer at the compound. Thompson submachine guns had been issued to the Brigante commando. Somehow, assault rifles were not available, but Thompson's were all right for this duty. Lars had been briefed. He had been given two picked men armed with submachine guns. He was to go to the compound. He was to lie in wait, inside, until Storm along appeared, and then, with a minimum of disturbance, was to take him in custody. Lars was to bring him here to the courtroom. He was not to alarm Tyler into combat. When Tyler had been formally charged, he would be told his case would be tried by the World Court, to be formed in a couple of weeks, and then taken to the old village. House arrest and awaiting trial were terms Brown Limper had looked up. He would inform Tyler that he was under house arrest. Then it was up to Lars to get him to the meadow. There must be no chance taken of alerting cadets or some Russians holding out at the old tomb. Lars had said, "I think I should grab him while he's still in Turl's office." Brown Limper said, "No. Turl has assured me that he can undo any mischief Tyler may get up to if he gets in the office. He has probably remained behind to do something criminal after the others finished. You want to take him alone. The other two might help him. We are after the criminal Tyler. We must get him here smoothly, charge him, and get him up to the meadow. Be polite. Grant any ordinary request. Be smooth. Cause no disturbance. And don't damage the office. That is a request Turl made." It all seemed a bit muddy and out of sequence to Lars in the briefing, but he got the essential points. He got his two Brigantes, made sure they had their submachine guns, got an executive armored ground car, and left. Brown Limper told General Smith, "Keep your mercenaries out of sight at the compound, but be alert for trouble this morning. Tell them not to start shooting unless they are attacked." General Smith got it. His men were ready to earn their pay. Brown Limper had found the pattern of judicial robes judges used to wear, and he had one made for this occasion. He got into it, hopping over to the window and looking out between times, and finally gazed at himself in an old, cracked mirror. The time of reckoning for a lifetime of abuse and insult was at hand. 4. Johnny strode 2 paces inside the door of Char's room, the muzzle of a submachine gun jammed into his left side. A Brigante rose from behind a chair, holding another Thompson grimly leveled. Lars stood up from behind the bed, a blast pistol pointing at him.
"We are not here to kill you," said Lars.
He had worked this entire campaign out and added a few embellishments of his own. From all he had heard, this was a treacherous and dangerous criminal liable to do anything. To carry out his principal orders, it was necessary to be very intelligent about this, as intelligent as Hitler would have been. "Just do as we request, and no harm will come to you. This is an entirely legal proceeding. You are under arrest by order of the council, and these are council troops." Johnny, as he entered, had been in the act of removing his air mask, or he would have smelled the badly tanned skins and body stench of a Brigante. An hour. Angus and Care required an hour to put the vital finishing touches on that office.
These creatures might go up to the office and might even have arrest orders for them. He would buy Angus and Kerr that hour. He realized then that Lars and these two Brigantes had been here for a while. Kerr, when Johnny asked for work clothes, had simply bundled up all of Stormalong's gear. It had been in a neat kit by the bed. Now it was strewn about, thoroughly searched. The food bags from both Africa and the Academy were there. They had also been ransacked. Angus's gear had been very slight, and he had his tool bag with him, so there was no trace that two men's gear was in this pile. The Brigante behind him, with a glance at his mate to see that the action was covered, whisked the blast pistol out of Johnny's belt. Johnny shrugged. Buy time. And you are taking me somewhere?
You are to appear this morning before the council to be charged, said Lars.
Johnny casually swung the door shut behind him, closing out any view of the corridor. Angus and Kerr would not come out that way to go to the hangar, but they might make some noise. And worse, might foolishly abandon what they were doing and take these fellows on.
I haven't had anything to eat since yesterday, said Johnny. Do you mind if I have a bite first?
Lars stepped back to the wall. The Brigante behind him backed away. The one behind the chair stepped to another position, and Johnny collected up the food bag contents and water gourds and sorted them out. He sat down and drank some water out of a gourd. There were some bananas there, and he broke some off the small bunch. The Brigantes hadn't seen any bananas since leaving Africa and eyed them. Johnny offered them some, and they would have taken them, except that Lars barked a reprimand and they quickly snapped back to military duties. Johnny ate a banana. Then he found some millet bread and made himself a sandwich from local beef. He had quite a hard time selecting the exact right slices. The huge Cyclo wristwatch on his wrist was whirring off the seconds and minutes. He had marked it for the hour.
What are these charges all about? Said Johnny.
Lars smiled very thinly. He was being pumped for confidential council information.
You will be told in the proper time by the proper people.
Johnny finished the sandwich and found some wild berries. He ate these. The wristwatch whirred along. 49 minutes to go. He looked into the food bags and discovered some wild sugar cane from Africa. He peeled it with care and chewed on it, sipping from the gourd between times. Then it occurred to him, if they were all silent, Angus or Kerr might come bursting in here to see whether he was gone. Angus would suppose Johnny had taken his kit to the plane, but still, they might just come barging in and get arrested or shot. Very shortly now, he had better start this Lars talking, so they would hear a strange voice in here. 42 minutes to go.
You sure messed up my clothes, said Johnny. I'll have to repack.
But Lars was intent on something else. He wanted a real double check on identity, and in his haste he had forgotten it. He wanted to make doubly sure about the collar scars. He became clever. A military maneuver was needed here. He didn't want this Tyler to be able to seize a Brigante and use him as a shield. Right now, the collar of the work jacket covered his neck.
There is no idea of inconveniencing you, said Lars. You are in your work clothes, and I should think you would want to appear at your best before such an august body as the council. You can change your clothes if you wish. We've removed all knives and weapons, so go ahead.
Johnny had smiled wryly when august body of the council was mentioned. What pomposity. But he said,
Oh, well, in that case, I suppose I had better.
He began to sort the scattered clothes into piles, making noise. It would be better if he could keep Lars talking. 39 minutes to go. Kerr certainly had brought all of Stormalong's kit. He folded it all neatly and then began packing up items and looking at them critically as though deciding which he should wear, saying, Would this do? And, How about this? And, How do they ordinarily dress when appearing before the council?
In something like this?
He got Lars advising him. The council was very formal, very strict and mindful of its dignity, and its power was enormous, and men were expected to realize it. 28 minutes to go.
Johnny suddenly saw that Stormalong, who was always very neat as well as a bit dashing about clothes, had preserved the costume he had been issued in load days to look like Johnny. Chrissy had made several sets, pushed into it by Johnny to take her mind off her imprisonment, and Johnny had handed out sets to Donald Dean, Thor, and Stormalong to improve their duplication. He unwrapped the buckskin hunting shirt and breeches and belt. Yes, even the moccasins. 23 minutes to go. Johnny took off his jacket, intending to sponge off a bit before dressing. Lars leaned forward eagerly. Turl had told him that a good security chief always depended upon body marks for identification. How right. There were the small scars of the collar. He had his man. He became inwardly jubilant, cheerful. "You can hurry it along now, Tyler," said Lars. "I know you for sure. The collar scars." So that's what he had been looking for, thought Johnny. "The others left hours ago, didn't they?" said Lars. "Well, yes, as a matter of fact, they did," said Johnny. It came to him that the others had been logged out when they went to the academy to install the recorders, and must not have been logged back in. Great. 20 minutes to go. "And you stayed behind to rig some little tricks of your own, didn't you?" said Lars. "We'll find them later, never fear. Your masquerade is over, Tyler." Lars thought that was pretty good. He had thought it up himself. "Get dressed." Johnny took a piece of buckskin and gave himself a sponge bath, a procedure looked upon with total amazement by the Brigantes. They had never seen nor heard of anyone ever taking a bath. "How did you get on to me?" asked Johnny. "I'm afraid," said Lars, that is a state secret." "Ah," said Johnny. 17 minutes to go. "Something you learned from Hitter or Bitter or whomever that was?" He recalled Kerr mentioning this fellow was crazy on the subject. "You mean Hitler," corrected Lars angrily. "Ah, Hitler," said Johnny. "That doesn't sound like a cyclo name. Cyclo names aren't two syllables, usually. Sometimes they are, though."
"Hitler was not a cyclo," said Lars emphatically. "He was a man. He was the greatest military leader and the holiest church member man ever had."
"Must have been a long time ago," said Johnny. 15 minutes and 17 seconds to go. They were almost in the clear for their 45 minutes. But it could be an hour. "Well, yes," said Lars. "It was a long time ago." "How'd Lars ever find out about Hitler?" "Well, his family was from Sweden, and they were very literate. In fact, his father was a minister. And they had some old books the church had kept that had been printed by the German War Propaganda Ministry, in the purest Swedish, and it really was inspirational. It seems that to be really religious, one had to be a pure Aryan, and an Aryan was really a Swede. Most people in the tribe had the colossal nerve to scoff at such holy creeds, but it had been the state religion of Sweden." "I wish I'd heard about him sooner," said Johnny. 12 minutes and 7 seconds to go. "Was he really a great leader?" "Oh, indeed he was, make no mistake about that. Hitler had conquered the whole world and enforced racial purity. You should really read those books. They are truly marvelous." "Oh, you can't read Swedish? Well, I could read them to you." "What's some parts of them?" "Oh, well, it would take weeks to cover it all. But, for instance, there's a part of a book called Mein Kampf that outlines the whole destiny of the race. You see, there are really supermen and just plain men, and to be a superman, one has to study and know the religious creed of fascism." "Did they worship God?" said Johnny. 7 minutes and 12 seconds to go. He began to dress, taking care with the thongs. "Well, of course. God's real name was Der Führer, but Hitler had taken his place on Earth to make a world of peace and goodwill. Now, Napoleon was also a military leader, and before him was Caesar, and before him was Alexander the Great, and before him was Attila the Hun. But these men were not holy. One really had to know history to tell the difference. Now, even though Napoleon was a great military leader, on many points he didn't favorably compare with Hitler. Even though Napoleon had conquered Russia, he did not show the finesse Hitler showed when he conquered Russia. Now, all this was very ancient and a long time ago, and man had come to grief since,
though not through any fault of Hitler's. So it was obvious that if man were to rise and be great again, they should follow the creed of religious fascism. And who knew but what some new Hitler might arise to bring peace on earth and goodwill toward men like Hitler had. It's a funny thing, you know, but his mother used to say, when she looked at the old pictures, that he, Lars, quite closely resembled. The distant roar of a car starting up, the snarl of its going around the ramps to exit, the unmistakable mad driving of care. They were gone. Johnny finished dressing, packed the kit, especially Stormalong's favorite coat and scarf and goggles, and bundled it all up.